We did leave off in the third volume on page 77. You recall that this is a side study as we start Revelation, the 13th chapter. The side study is on the heads and the horns. And particularly, we would say 7 heads and 10 horns. And we've been considering last week in Revelation the 3 different chapters in which that expression in Revelation 12, the dragon had 7 heads and 10 horns, crowns on the heads. Revelation 13, the beast had 7 heads and 10 horns with the crowns on the horns. And in Revelation 17, we have the 7 heads and 10 horns. Then we went to Daniel. We're in Daniel, the 7th chapter. we're going to reread all these scriptures after we're done with our volume reading. And we're in the 7th chapter. And you remember there's the 4 universal empires that had dominion over Israel for the period known as the Gentile times. 2520 years starting in 606 BC. So the thought being that the thought being that the first 3 beasts shown in Daniel 7 was Babylon and Medo-Persia, Greece. The 4th is Rome. That's where we're focusing our attention currently. It has horns. It doesn't mention multiple heads in Daniel 7. We just know there's the one head of on this 4th beast that's mentioned. The thought would be that Safari can't find BibleToday.com for me.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but it was working this morning, and I use it to get my volumes. So okay.
Well, that's unusual, though, don't you think, Brother Adi?
Yeah, I'll have to put a ticket in for the. For them.
Okay. Yeah, that was Google Chrome. We'll find it. Sister Alice.
I have just a quick question. Revelation 12, the red dragon, the crowns are on the heads. Revelation 13, leopard-like beast, crowns are on the horns. Revelation 17, the scarlet beast, no crowns. How come? What does that mean?
The crowns on the head, when it appears in Revelation 12 with the dragon, is demonstrating that the government, the head or government in that period of time or that scriptural context, in Revelation 12, demonstrated that the civil power was in control. In Revelation 13, with the 7 heads and 10 horned beasts, which is papacy, the papal system, with the crowns on the heads, demonstrates that even though the papacy is in control, yet the civil power are the horns that support her when the papacy is the head. So it's almost like saying when you look at a civil context like the dragon, the crown will be on the heads because the civil power is in control. When we look at the beast as a head, the crowns will be on the horn, showing that a religious government is in control. That seems to be the distinction. And in Revelation 17, the crowns aren't mentioned because in 17, it's a unique picture where the religious element of papacy is depicted in the harlot woman. And the religious aspect of federated Protestants are depicted in the harlot woman's daughters, while the civil powers are represented by the horns, which are kings. So we'll get back, you know, as we process this further, that'll come back up again from time to time. But we think that's the basic distinction. Did someone else have a comment on that point? Okay. So let's continue our reading. It's because it's, we can only but benefit by reading on this. Third volume, page 77. But actually, I think we're going to pick up on the bottom of 76, the prophet. And, Ruth, do you have that? And just read that one paragraph and let's, digest that again.
The prophet had said that three horns would be plucked up or rooted out to make room or prepare the way for this peculiar power or horn. And so we find it. Constantine built Constantinople and removed his capital thither. This, though favorable to papacy's development in the seat of the Caesars, was unfavorable to the empire. And soon it was found expedient to divide the empire, and Italy was thenceforth known as the Western Empire, whose seat or capital was at Ravenna. This was one of the horns. It fell AD 476 at the hands of the Heruli, another of the horns, which established itself on its ruins. Next came the Ostrogothic kingdom, another horn, overthrowing the Heruli and establishing itself as ruler of Italy, AD 489. And as we have just seen, it was during the power of this horn, the third to be rooted out to make way for the papal horn, that Justinian acknowledged the papal supremacy. And it was by his orders and by his general and his army that it was plucked up. And as we have seen, its plucking up was necessary to the advancement of papacy to power as a peculiar blending of political and religious power, a peculiar horn differing from its fellows. Indeed, it seems not improbable that the papacy was secretly favorable to the fall of each of these horns or powers, hoping thus to open the way to its own exaltation, just as it finally resulted.
All right. Thank you. So before I ask you to comment on that, Ruth, just looking again at this map, as it were. Brother Chris has a good one behind him, too. The thought is that here is Rome. Here's Ravenna. And here is Constantinople, formerly known as Byzantium, currently known as Istanbul. So, and this red outline, more or less, is part of the empire under Justinian I that came later, down here, 527, for example. But we want to say that, to repeat, that Rome is our focus because that's our Bishop of Rome, who is the Pope, and that is where the Vatican sits. And that has been the seat of papacy from the very beginning. And Rome, of course, was the seat of the Roman Empire before papacy ever came along, back when, you know, paganism under the Republic of Rome, B.C. But when Constantine accepted Christianity about 313 A.D., Christianity had been around for not quite 300 years, 33 AD to 313 AD, not quite 300 years. Constantine became a nominal Christian. Christianity was legalized, as it were, religious freedom, as we know, we've been talking about. However, Constantine felt that he should move his seat of empire over to Byzantium, built the city, elaborated on the city, called it Constantinople. And so this became the center of the Roman Empire government thereafter. That was 330-331 AD. And subsequently, the Bishop of Rome stays in Rome. However, the ruling representatives of the western part of the empire, who were representing the eastern, empire and Constantine, they moved their seat of government to Ravenna. As we had mentioned, that the ruler would like to have his army nearby for protection, and they moved their army to the top of the Italian peninsula because the majority of the threats came from the Goths and other what they call barbarians, which would come down through the peninsula and, they would sack Rome or they would take over Ravenna. And so we keep seeing the name Ravenna pop up even in this paragraph. So then Ruth, now turning back to you, excuse me, what would you take away from what you read here in your own words?
Well, papacy was developing in the background all along with all these political events taking place. And as papacy was developing and growing, you had the Western Empire that had to be taken out. That was one of the horns. Then they were replaced by the Heruli, which is another of the horns, and then they were replaced by the Ostrogoths, which was the third horn. And as all this was happening throughout the decades, papacy was developing as this little horn that eventually came up and took the place of those three. But when you read in Daniel 7:8, if you just read it on the surface, it sounds like three horns were plucked up at once for papacy, but actually he's explaining how it's a process. One replaced the other, which the third replaced the second, and then papacy came along and was able to replace all three of them with itself as the horn in 539 eventually. So that's what I get out of this paragraph.
Okay, very good. We appreciate that. Okay. So the friends have this, and they see the dating, and you see the process. And so we're going to keep reading. Is there anything more on this particular paragraph? Okay, Brother Chris?
I just want to throw an additional, while you've got your map up there, the very fact that everything was moved to Byzantium, it left that big power void over there in Italy. That was why it was so attractive for everybody to go there, because there wasn't really a major force. The empire was all congested there over in Byzantium. But what's interesting is that when you look at the extent of the empire under Justinian, all that darker red, it shows these were like major trade areas and routes into other nations. That's why it's so critical. And the main point I wanted to make was, if you see up above Constantinople, Istanbul now, the Black Sea, you'll see it includes Crimea, which even Putin today recognize. That's always been an area lusted after by those in that area because of its position for trade from the Black Sea to get you up into Ukraine and that whole area of Eastern Europe. So I just wanted to point that out, that it's always been part of everyone who conquers that area. They want to have Crimea involved. So over.
All right. Thank you, Brother Chris. Sister Roseanne.
Yeah, Brother Rick, I'm just looking for clarification. We're saying that the three horns, was it Ravenna that fell is the first horn? And then the second horn that fell was Heruli. And then the third was the Ostrogoths. Am I getting that, or?
So a little, that's good. I'm glad you asked that. The first horn that fell was not Ravenna. Ravenna was the location. The power is called the Western Empire. So the Western Empire was the first to fall. The Heruli were Goths. And I, on the email that I sent out, over a week ago now, we outlined some of the different Goth tribes. The Goths were from the north. Mainly, they're considered Germanic tribes. The Heruli was the one. And they defeated the Western Empire. And they ceded at Ravenna. Then the Heruli were defeated by another Goth empire, the Ostrogoths, who then also ceded themselves at Ravenna. Even though they controlled larger area, those were the three heads, Western Empire, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths, and they're in sequence of who was controlling it. Brother Chris.
I'm sorry, I didn't take my hand down, but just for emphasis, all those Germanic tribes were, they didn't recognize papacy, and they were more, non-Trinitarian, followed,
Arius.
Arius, thank you, over.
Yes, that's true. And that comes into play when we finally get to, the Franks. Sister Debbie.
Just a little history note. The Goths originated in southern Scandinavia and crossed in three ships under their king Berig to the southern shore of the Baltic Sea, where they settled after defeating the Vandals and other Germanic people in that area. So you could say that the Goths were originally Scandinavian and joined the Germanic tribes when they, you know, came across. Over. Just a little history. That's all. Over.
It's not quite that simple, but that, you know, for a quick internet reference, that's okay. They are from the north, a little more involved, but that's okay. Thank you. Well, let's keep reading then. And Sister Debbie, since you had a good clear mic there, why don't you read our next paragraph for us, please?
Okay. With the overthrow of the Ostrogoths, the Roman emperor was recognized for some time as the ruler of Italy and was represented by exarchs. But since these had their capital at Ravenna and not at Rome, and since they had come to recognize the papacy in the manner shown, it follows that from AD 539, papacy was recognized as the chief authority in the city of Rome, and that from that date, when it was set up, it began to grow and thrive as a horn or power among the other horns or powers, representing the formerly united power of Rome. The fact of the greatly disturbed condition of Italy, and especially of Rome, about this period, subject to the pillage of invaders from the north, as well as to heavy taxes by whichever master was nearest at the time, helped to break up political loyalty to the imperial power at Constantinople, so that the church rulers, always with them, speaking the same language and sharing their advantages and losses, were readily accepted by the people as the advisors, protectors, and rulers of the city of Rome and its environs.
All right, very good. So your takeaway from this, Sister Debbie?
That because of their isolation from Constantinople and because of taxes and all the other people that wanted to invade, the people in Italy started to accept the Pope as their ruler because, well, you know, it's the same language, same area, same people, you know, so they kind of got away from the Roman Empire, or, you know, the rulers of Constantinople because they were more alone. Over.
Okay. Not very good. Very good. It was almost by default, because of the transition of power to Constantinople from Rome, and over time, that's developed. And so the one constant figure was the Bishop of Rome. He was always in Rome. The Vatican was always in Rome. And he was a recognized authority at some level. Like we say, just by default, the other powers up in Ravenna continued to change. Now, what's the meaning of the word exarch? And then I'll call on Brother James. What's the meaning of the word exarch? Sister Roseanne?
Leader.
Okay.
As a note, leader.
Okay, very good. Brother Chris?
I just looked it up. It said a governor of a distant province under Byzantine emperors.
Okay, very good. Very good. That word we're going to develop a little bit more, but let's take this comment from the Hughes.
Thank you, Brother Rick. Just a quick analogy to this period of history to something contemporary. I think of it in a similar way as in Afghanistan, when different big superpowers have been in control of Afghanistan. When they leave, there's a power vacuum, and the Taliban always takes control of the civil authority. Even though they're a religious group, they've been there for a really long time, and the people all respect their authority, and they have a hierarchy and a system kind of set up in place. And so as soon as there's a power vacuum, the Taliban takes control again, regardless of the local governments that are set up in the capital. In all the places where the Taliban is, they always end up ruling. So in this similar way here, we have all these different horns, these different authorities ruling. And then when they're kicked out by Justinian, it would just make sense to the people that the Bishop of Rome would have civil authority. Over.
Okay, very good. Very good. So, brethren, when we read in the first volume, we're going to read about a phrase called Eastern Exarchs. When we read the first volume, we'll talk on that. But we want to notice that when Brother Russell uses that term in the first volume, he's actually referring to the time period that here on page 77 at the top, he's calling the Western Empire. And when we look at the two, first volume and this third volume, when we read there, we want to look at the time frame that Brother Russell is referring to. The Western Empire can be considered as an Eastern Exarch in that the Western Empire was the lesser, whereas Constantinople in the East was the superior. That's true. But there is a very specific historical period of time called the Eastern Exarch. If you were to look that up historically, Google it or whatever, it would fit in better with this paragraph that we just read when it talks about when the Ostrogoths were overthrown. The Roman emperor was recognized for some time as the ruler of Italy and was represented by exarchs, and they had their capital at Ravenna. That is the historical period known as the Eastern Exarch. Even though Brother Russell uses that phrase for the time period as the Western Empire. And we understand why he uses it. The Western Empire was a lesser authority than the Eastern Empire. But just a note, when we read it in the first volume, we just don't want that to throw us off. And so we're just going to make mention of that here. Now, the other main point we get out of the, oh, sorry, Sister Day.
Just a question. Wasn't there was a Western Exarchate and then there was an Eastern Exarchate. Weren't there like both East and Western Exarchates? That's all I'm asking over.
So the Western Exarchate, if you like, would be the Western Empire. In the first volume, Brother Russell refers to that as the Eastern Exarchate. But here in the third volume, the Eastern Exarchate is really after the Ostrogoths are defeated. So we're just trying to highlight that. Sister Debbie.
So does that mean the Exarchates were only in Italy and not everywhere? Because I thought they were like Eastern Empire, Western Empire, that sort of thing, over.
It means they're only in Italy. Yeah. Ruth.
Well, according to that definition that someone just said, I can't remember who it was, the Exarchate, it confused me. I know it's confusing. It's a representative of a distant government. So the government was in the East, but the Exarch was in the West representing the East. So that's why it's like West and East were like the same area. It's very confusing, but anyway, over.
Yep, very good. Very good. Okay. Now we just want to highlight again, we're going to see more of this, but Brother Russell in this paragraph brings out that from 539 AD, papacy was recognized as the chief authority in the city of Rome. And from that date when it was set up, it began to grow and thrive as a horn in power among other horns or powers. So I just want to emphasize that again, we talked about this last week, that in Daniel, the papacy is depicted by a horn, not a head. And in the Revelation, papacy is represented by a head, not a horn. And that's why we're having this side study, to hopefully try to make that clear in each of our minds. And here's the main takeaway. I'm going to keep referring to this today as we read. The main takeaway is, even though the papal system was not ahead in 539, yet it was a horn and it was set up in power. But we think that power would grow in influence until 800, and it crowned the king, Charlemagne, and it had the papal states. That's when we begin, in our minds, the papacy as a head. And that would begin the Holy Roman Empire in a larger sense. The Pope actually crowned the king. So that's, in my mind, where the papacy becomes a head in Revelation, but here it's a horn and it's growing in power. So just to repeat that, we don't think the papacy had to be a head in order to be set up in power. We think it was set up in power as a horn, 539, prior to it becoming a head in 800. Just showing the progression. When we get back to Revelation, we'll look at that again, because you and I, when we studied Revelation 12, we studied that transition period of papacy from the man of sin being born, 313, 325, developing 539, Michael warring with the dragon all the way to 800 and then gains the supremacy. So it shows a transition of power. Okay. But let's keep reading and we'll see how this fills out a little bit more here. And, Sister Molly, are you able to read on page 78 there? And why don't you read a couple of paragraphs, please?
Okay. That's starting with no doubt.
Yes.
No doubt, indeed, the object of Justinian in acknowledging the claims of the Bishop of Rome to superiority over others was also in part to gain his cooperation in the war he was about to wage against the Ostrogoths, to regain Italy as part of the Eastern Roman Empire. For the influence of the Pope and the Church was considerable even then, and to have them on his side in the war was half the conquest won at the very outstart. Though the Goths rebelled against the empire and sacked the city of Rome, they did not reestablish their rule, and its only government was that of the Church. And though the Lombard kingdom soon came in and established its rule over most of Italy, even overthrowing the rule of the Eastern Empire established by Justinian in the hands of the exarchs, yet be it carefully noted that the Lombards recognized the authority of the papacy in Rome. It was not until near the end of that kingdom, in the 8th century, that any serious attempts were made against the papal authority, the narrative of which only serves to establish were Rome's real rulers, the claimed successors of the Caesars, the spiritual Caesars. Though they claimed the protection of the government at Constantinople as long as it advantaged them to do so, when the Lombards finally sought to take possession of Rome, the Pope appealed to the French king to protect the Church, papacy, and to maintain them in their what they called the patrimony of St. Peter, which they claimed had been upon the Church by Constantine.
Okay, thank you very much. So, what's your takeaway from this, Sister Molly?
Well, it seemed like this area of Italy was very destabilized all through this time, and lots of groups trying to take control. But they, like was has been commented, the Goths, the Lombards, in the end, they still recognized the papacy as the established ruler. So they kind of leaned on that in a way to control the people. And in so doing, it strengthened the papal authority even more. I guess finally at the end of the paragraph, when the Lombards wanted to take possession of Rome, then papacy sought after some help. French rulers, Pepin and Charlemagne. It's Charlemagne who would later be crowned by the papacy for the good deeds. So that's all.
Okay, very good. Now that's a good summary. Other comments on these paragraphs? Burden.
Brother Rick, it's brought out that Justinian needed or wanted the influence of the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, in this war that was going to be waged against the Ostrogoths. So we see that it was certainly, in part at least, for a political reason that he recognized the Pope as the supreme bishop, if you will, of bishops, and wanting the Pope in his corner in this war that was going to be waged. So that was one of the reasons for this recognition. And I'll just leave it there. Over.
All right. Very good. That's good. So, Brother, if we were to just to put it as simply as possible, it's an oversimplification. Brother Russell is bringing out these aspects of history from about 313 to about 800. So let's think about that. 313 to about 800. Basically 5 centuries, about 500 years roughly. From the time the Roman Empire was Christianized to the time the Holy Roman Empire got established. He's demonstrating how it came about. How the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, gained that kind of authority to be crowning a king, emperor over the Roman Empire. And he's demonstrating how historically this came to be. And so we're reading the back and forth of the different powers during that 500 years, more or less, that came down into Italy. And Brother Russell is laser pointed on Rome because the scriptures are laser pointed on Rome. And it's because Rome becomes the seat of the beast, the great Antichrist system. So with that in mind, even though we could put in more dates and more names of the various leaders and such, which is of interest, but it's not of interest for all equally. And so we won't delve into that any further, as fascinating as it is for some of us. We could all read on it. But we want to stay focused on the point, even as Brother Russell is, to sort this through as best we can. So let's read a little more here. I think just had us to the top of page 79. So, Brother James, could you read that top paragraph for us, please?
The French kings, Pepin and Charlemagne, each in turn brought his army for the protection of papacy's dominion and vanquished the Lombards. It was the latter of these who in AD 800 formally presented to papacy several states known as the Papal States, already referred to, additional to the city and suburbs of Rome, actually held by papacy from AD 539. So then, the Lombard kingdom, or horn, did not hinder nor occupy the place of the papal horn, as some have surmised, even though it did sometimes crowd it.
Okay, takeaway thoughts on that, Brother James?
Just that it was these French kings, I believe, that was father and son, in that order, Pepin and Charlemagne, that helped remove the Lombard, protect papacy so that they, you know, in the previous paragraph, it said that the Bishop of Rome kind of, used the idea that they were successive and they had to maintain their succession. And so the, French kings, Pepin and Charlemagne, that appealed to them. So they helped them out. And even though it was crowded in that area in the Papal States, it didn't, the Papal States actually maintained and I believe even grew from that point, expanded over.
Okay, very good. So, yes, you put it very well. And again, this is one of those things that's a little confusing. They are the French kings, but they were Germanic tribes, the Franks. And yet they ended up residing in the area we would call France today or on this map, for example. And yet, I think Ruth had posted the article a couple of weeks ago out of online magazine. But it demonstrated that Pepin and Charlemagne were Trinitarians. And, the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, was Trinitarian, as we know. And the Lombards and these others, as have been mentioned, were primarily Arian. They didn't believe in the Trinity. So there was a natural guidance, we believe, of course, by Satan's hand, to empower the Trinitarians. And that is indeed what happened. Even Justinian the First was a Trinitarian before this, a couple hundred years before this. And that's one of the reasons he liked the Bishop of Rome, because they were both in their beliefs. But okay, we have Pepin the First. Actually, the Bishop of Rome had traveled into outside a Paris, outside a suburb, and anointed Pepin. And Pepin then first dedicated the Papal States. Pepin defeated the Lombards about in the 750s, but then the Lombards reascended and started to move in on Rome. And so Charlemagne, Pepin's son, came, and he finally defeated the Lombards in 774, finally defeated them. And then this eventually led to the coronation of Charlemagne and the further establishment militarily of the papacy to have the Papal States. And here's a question out of the blue. How long did the papacy have the Papal States? When were they taken away? And they were left only with Vatican City. Anyone remember? Brother Dan.
I believe it was 1870 when they lost the Papal States.
Okay, and who did that? Who took it away?
Who was that? I can look at your notes. Oh, there it is. Victor Emmanuel.
Right, indeed. And Brother also brings that out, and we'll read about it. It's not anything special we had, but that's true. So that was Victor Emmanuel the First, and took away the Papal States in 1870. Okay. All right, so that's what we had to read here. Did anyone have anything more here? Otherwise, we'll move to a next reading. Okay, Ruth?
Well, I was just thinking, this all seems so ancient. All these events are so ancient. But when you think about Rome today, even though they lost the Papal States, they're the ones, the papacy is the ones that are the stability in that area even today, because it's the... you know, whenever these world leaders go visit somebody, they go to the Pope. They don't go to the leader of Italy or the particular. I couldn't even tell you who the ruler of Italy is now, but everyone knows the Pope. So it's still a very pertinent fact. Over.
Yeah, the Pope, you know, they claim that there's over a billion Roman Catholics on the planet, and there's not a billion people in Italy. So that tells you who has more influence. The Pope has more influence than the president or premier of Italy. That's for sure. Okay. Very good. Let's go to the first volume. Let's get that one read, as it were. And, the first volume we'd like to read on page 258 and 259. 258. And, let's see, Sister Roseanne, when you get that, maybe you could read for us. I'm going to have you start on, .257. And start with that where it's, but now. And brother, if we're on page 257, if you're looking at a book, you can't help but see that on the previous page, we're in a subheading called Daniel's Vision of Earthly Governments. And so, that's where we'll start reading here. But 257, but now.
just that one paragraph, Brother Rick?
No, you can read two, please.
Okay. But now, calling to mind the difference of standpoint, let us look at the same four universal empires on earth from the standpoint of God and those in harmony with him. As portrayed in vision to the beloved prophet Daniel, as to us, these kingdoms appear inglorious and beastly. So to him, these four universal empires were shown as four great ravenous wild beasts. And to his view, the coming kingdom of God, the stone, was proportionately grander than as seen by Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel says, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven strove upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse, one from another. The first one was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. And behold, another beast, a second, like a bear, and lo, another, like a leopard. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, a dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth. It devoured and break in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were with it, and it had 10 horns. The details relative to the first three beasts, Babylon the lion, Media Persia the bear, Greece the leopard, with their heads, feet, wings, etc., all of which are symbolic, we pass by as of less importance in our present examination than the details of the fourth beast, Rome.
Okay, thank you. And brother, those details we'll look at a little bit when we get back to Revelation 13, because they're highlighted, so it's good to have read. But Sister Roseanne, any particular takeaway from these paragraphs?
We're looking at that vision that we talked about last week, but what it seems to me is that we're looking at it from God's point of view, and that these were, he views them as wild beasts, ravenous beasts. And the three, of course, are the Babylon, Media, Persia, and Greece. And the fourth, as we talked about coming up, is talking about Rome, and I think, and how it devours everything else. I think that's all I have.
Okay. That's very good. It's kind of like a lead in to get us to the points we're interested in. So that's good. Okay. Thank you. Brother Michael, are you able to read?
Yes, I am.
Could you then read that next paragraph, and why don't you read two, please?
page 258. Of the fourth beast, Rome, Daniel says, after this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. And it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Daniel 7:7-8. Here, the Roman Empire is shown, and the divisions of its power are shown in the 10 horns, the horn being a symbol of power. The little horn which arose among these, and which appropriated the power of three of them to itself and ruled among the others, represents the small beginning and gradual rise to the power of the Church of Rome, the papal power or horn. As it rose in influence, three of the divisions, horns or powers of the Roman Empire, the Heruli, the Eastern Exarchate, and the Ostrogoth, were plucked out of the way to make room for its establishment as a civil power or Hun. This last specially notable Hun papacy is remarkable for its eyes, representing intelligence, and for its mouth, its utterances, its claims, etc.
Okay, very good. So, Brother Michael, opening comments on what you read?
I think Barroso was just basically trying to establish the growth of the papacy and how it grew through those three empires that were plucked out over time. It goes back to what we've already read as well in the third volume on how these three empires, the Heruli, was taken over by the Exarchate and then eventually by the Ostrogoths and eventually for papacy to come and establish itself. And in reference to how it was talked about in Daniel, it basically just emphasizes how, you know, the roots were plucked out and the mouth and with special emphasis on intelligence of the eyes and the mouth speaking great things. So I think it just goes to speak on the papacy being one, where its influence did not arise from owning an army, but more from its utterances and its ability to manipulate or to overrule people. End of comment.
Okay, very good. Very good. We appreciate that. And yes, you rightly assess Brother Russell's, again, laser pointed on the rise of papacy through it all. What is the difference, or what are the differences on these three horns and their order versus what we read in the third volume, which is more Brother Russell's being more definitive in the third volume? What's the differences? Brother Dan.
Brother Rick, the difference I picked out is the order in which he lists these three horns. He lists the Heruli first, and then the Western Empire, and then the Ostrogoths. So, and we think the proper order when he's being more specific, as brought out, is the Western Empire falls first, and then the to the Heruli, and then Heruli to the Ostrogoths. That's what we picked out.
Okay, very good. Anyone else on this? Okay, so again, like we said, on the third volume, it's the Western Empire, and here he's calling it the Eastern Exarch, but it's really the Western Empire. If there's a way you can look at it like it was the Eastern Exarch, because the Western Empire was inferior to the powers in Constantinople in the East. That's true. But we just thought it might be a little confusing if one was reading this and then reading in the third volume. We wanted to sort that. Now, you notice that in the third volume where we read, Brother Russell is putting dates on it, and he's showing the order of how which one was plucked up. That's why we have the detail there. Here, he's just saying in passing, these three were plucked up. He's not struggling with trying to get it in order for us. So that's the only real difference. It was not like he changed his mind or anything like that. We're not picking that way. Okay. The interesting point in this as well, as we see, is that the papacy didn't have an army. That's why they kept looking to these horns for its power. But it had the eyes of intelligence as brought out, and it had the mouth. It could make great boasting claims, which we're going to talk more about in Revelation 13, because it's the very, very same emphasis. But okay, let's read on a little bit more here. Sister Connie, could you read for us that next, let's see, two paragraphs?
Verse
To this fourth beast representing Rome, Daniel gives no descriptive name. While the others are described as lion-like, bear-like, and leopard-like, the fourth was so ferocious and hideous that none of the beasts of earth could be compared with it. John the Revelator, seeing in vision the same symbolic beast, government, was also at a loss for a name by which to describe it, and finally gives it several. Among others, he called it the devil. He certainly chose an appropriate name, for Rome, when viewed in the light of its bloody persecutions, certainly has been the most devilish of all earthly governments. Even in its change from Rome pagan to Rome papal, it illustrated one of Satan's chief characteristics. For he also transforms himself to appear as an angel of light, as Rome transformed itself from heathenism and claimed to be Christian, the kingdom of Christ. After giving some details regarding this last or Roman beast, and especially of its peculiar or papal horn, the prophet states that judgment against this horn would be rendered, and it would begin to lose its dominion, which would be consumed by gradual process until the beast should be destroyed.
All right. Very good. Comments on what you read, Sister Ken?
It describes these, the other beasts. He could describe them, the bear, the lion, the leopard. But when it comes to the fourth beast, John could only finally describe it as giving it the most evil of all of the beasts. And he calls it the devil, which really is, it is the devil's plan. This was his baby, so to speak. And it talks about that eventually this horn, this devil is going to be destroyed in the end. So that's it.
Yeah, that's right on. Very good. Thank you. Any other comments on these paragraphs? Okay. So again, Brother Russell is just very simply pointing out that when we got to the Roman Empire, and we want to remember it was during the Roman Empire that Christianity came into history. I'm going to say, no, this is so obvious. But Christianity didn't come along during Babylon, Media Persia, or Greece. It came along during the period of the Roman Empire, as prophesied. And so now Satan wanted to try to snuff out Christianity with pagan Roman persecution. And when that failed, he then transformed as an angel of light to create the Roman papal empire by which to persecute the saints and deceive the masses to become nominally Christian. So that's really Brother Russell's point here. But let's read this one more paragraph on this page. And Brother Adi, are you able to read?
Yes.
Okay.
After giving, is that where it started?
This beast, or
Roman Empire in its horns or divisions still exists and will be slain by the rising of the masses of the people and the overthrow of governments in the day of the Lord, preparatory to the recognition of the heavenly rulership. This is clearly shown from other scriptures yet to be examined. However, the consuming of the papal horn comes first. Its power and influence began to consume when Napoleon took the Pope prisoner to France. Then when neither the curses of the popes nor their prayers delivered them from Bonaparte's power, it became evident to the nations that the divine authority and power claimed by the papacy were without foundation. After that, the temporal power of the papacy waned rapidly until September 1870. It lost the last vestige of its temporal power at the hands of Victor Emmanuel.
Okay, very good. Your takeaway, Brother Adi?
So the papal authority is to go first before the Roman Empire goes, and it was consumed by Napoleon when he took the Pope prisoner to France. And finally, the last temporal power was at the hands of Victor Emmanuel. But it did come back. It does come back in power later on for a short period of time. Over.
Yes, we fully agree with that. Yes. And Brother Russell brings that out too in other places, but, yes, he's very good. He's showing the prophetic fulfillment of these verses that showed this decline of papacy. All right. By the way, Victor Emmanuel was excommunicated even though he never gave up his Roman Catholic beliefs. He did get excommunicated, and he's recognized as the modern day unifier of Italy. And he has a little dynasty that continues, but it's we'll get to more of that at some point in time, but just a little thought on that. Okay. So we're done on the first volume. Did anyone want to make any comments here before we shut this book? Okay, let's go to the second volume. And in the second volume, we wanted to pick up on page, we're going to read in two places. I don't know if we're going to get it all done today, but nonetheless, 304. And, we wanted to read, let's see, what do I have here? We want to just read a little bit here under this subheading, the head and mouth of Antichrist, his great swelling words. We wanted to connect that because it's on our verses. So let's just start reading there. And, Sister Carrie, are you able to read?
What does the paragraph start with?
It's, the Pope, each Pope in
the
his.
Pope, each, okay. The Pope and each Pope in his turn is the head of the false church, which is his body, even as Christ Jesus is the head of the true church, which is his body. Since the head is the representative of the body, and its mouth speaks for the body, we find, as we should expect, this feature of Antichrist prominently referred to in the scriptures. In Daniel 7, 8, 11, 25, in Revelations 13, 5 and 6, the mouth of Antichrist is brought specially to our notice as a leading characteristic. Daniel says this horn had eyes like the eyes of a man, symbolic of intelligence and a far-sighted policy. This horn was to be different from all the other powers. It was to be more wise, more cunning than the other empires which attempted to rule the world. Its power was to be that of its mouth, utterance, guided by its eyes, knowledge, rather than that of physical force. And no one acquainted with the history of papacy can deny that the figures used to illustrate its power and methods are strikingly good. And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things, and he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And he shall speak great words against the Most High. Revelations 13, 5, 6, and Daniel 7, 8, and 25. It should not be forgotten that these are figurative expressions descriptive of the character and claims of a symbolic beast, government, and horn power out of the old Roman beast or empire. In some respects, papacy was a new government beast distinct from the old Roman Empire, and in others, it was a horn or power among others out of that empire, which for a time held superior control over other horns or powers. It is presented in symbol from both these standpoints so as most thoroughly to locate and designate it.
Okay, very good. Comments on this, Sister Carrie?
I would sum it up by saying that the the strength or the power of the papacy was not with military might, but with its cunning and half-truths or psychological pressures or theologies or things like this would scare people into obedience. And it became it waned in power, and then it took on the most powerful, just depended during the times over the years, but it mostly had a lot of power directing the affairs of the early church and the government. That's it.
Oh, very well said. Very true. Very well put. And we got a long list. We're not going to read it, but on page 307, we have a long list of these blasphemies, which ends up being the Pope as a vicar of Christ taking on scriptural titles that belong to either God Almighty or his son Jesus Christ. And some are worse than others, but he takes them all. Okay, so I was done reading here on these pages. We were going to go to another part of the volume. Did anyone else have comments on what we just read? Okay, so we're okay. Sister Tulu, are you able to read?
My apologies. I'm just following along. I don't have the volumes with me today.
No problem. We certainly understand. Sister Brenda, are you able to read?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so we're going to pick up at the bottom of page 353, that subheading that starts the papal millennium. Could you read a couple of verses there for us, please?
Okay. Yes. The papal millennium, as the true kingdom of the true Christ is to last 1,000 years, so the papal counterfeit looks back upon a period of its greatest prosperity, which began AD 800 and closed in the dawn of the present century, as the fulfillment of the millennial reign foretold in Revelation 20. The period since in which papacy has gradually lost all its temporal power suffered many indignities from nations formerly its supporters, and have been greatly despoiled of territories, incomes, and liberties long claimed and possessed. Roman disregard the little season of Revelation 23:7-8 at the close of the millennium, during which Satan was to be loose, and the dates which mark the beginning and the close of papacy's millennium of ignorance, superstition, and fraud are clearly shown in history. A Roman Catholic writer thus refers to the beginning of its religious empire, the coronation of Charlemagne as Emperor of the West by Pope Leo AD 800, was really the commencement of the Holy Roman Empire.
Okay, very good. So just here in what you read here, Sister Brenda, can you put it in your own words, what you see?
So basically what's talking about here is that false papal millennium running from 800 to 799 AD. And we can see that at the end of it, they lost a lot of their supporters, their territories, and they considered that the loosening of Satan for the little season. So, that's over.
Okay, well, that's very good. Very good. So, further comments on these couple of paragraphs? So I think probably I could speak for all of us that when we were first taught that there was a counterfeit millennium from 800 AD with the crowning of Charlemagne by the Pope down to 1799 when Napoleon's general Berthier took the Pope prisoner and he died in Rome. We find that it's so remarkable that you would have such a dramatic counterfeit of the true millennium. Ruth.
And it's the time when history considers the Dark Ages. So they even recognize papacy's rule as being darkness.
Over. So true. Brother Adi.
So this period that we're in, according to Catholics, is considered the little season where Satan is loosed and deceives.
At least it was. I don't know if they emphasize that anymore. It's kind of a stretch. But yeah, that's what it was when Napoleon took over.
I'm just wondering what my next door neighbors think of me.
Okay, that's ask them if they're in the little season. Okay, so it's pretty clear. Again, Brother Russell's focusing on this on the papacy in Rome. Let's read a little more here. And Sister Wincy, are you able to read?
Yes, Brother.
Okay.
Starts from although, right?
Yes, please.
Although papacy was organized as a religious system long before and was even set up in temporal power in AD 539, yet it was Charlemagne who first actually bestowed and formally recognized the temporal dominion of the Pope. As Charlemagne was the first emperor over the Holy Roman Empire, AD 800, so Francis II was the last, and he voluntarily surrendered his title in AD 1806. As prior to the year 800, papacy was rising, supported by the Roman beast people and by its horns powers. So since the Holy Roman Empire was the title of the great political institution of the Middle Ages, it had its start in Charlemagne. Fisher's Universal History, B262, describes it thus. In theory, it was a union of the world state and the world church.
Wait a minute. Sorry, Sister Wincy. Somehow I got lost. You went on page 354. There's a big footnote in our brown volume. And
I think I'm reading the footnote. Should I ignore that and go to the next one?
Yes, please.
Okay, so since 1800, it has been cast off from temporal authority over kings and peoples and has been torn and pillaged by those who formerly gave its support. Revelation 17, 16 and 17. Today, thou still the recipient of honors and still possessed of wide influence over the consensus of the people, papacy bemoans its loss of everything resembling temporal dominion. Should I continue, Brenda?
Let's see. I see our time is fleeing. Why don't you stop here and tell us what you read?
Okay. So I think it talks about the beginning of 1260 years, which is 539, in which they officially organized as a religious system. And also we have 800 AD, which is we just spoke about the thousand-year kingdom that papacy declares. That starts from 800 to 1799. And I think, maybe I'll stop there. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. So further comments on this paragraph. So let me highlight a couple of points. And again, I think we'll come back and reread on this page and a few more paragraphs next week. We didn't quite get it done. But a few things to highlight. When Brother Russell puts in the paragraph that papacy was rising, supported by the Roman beast, and he has it as people. While that's okay, the way I would word it is that it's the body of the beast. the body of the beast, the body of the empire is the people. The head of the beast is the government. And the horns, as noted here, are the powers which the government controls. So we have the seven heads and the ten horns. And the beast, we read earlier today, Brother Russell says it's the government. And that, we think, is an emphasis. But it's true that the body of the beast, in other words, if the head is the government, the horns are the powers, they got, the head has to sit on a body, and the body would represent the people. So there's that perspective. And then in this Revelation 17, verse 16 and 17 that he cites here, our personal understanding is this is still a future development and a future demise. We do understand how he's using it. I'm going to suggest he's using it in an accommodated sense. To just show that since 1799, or actually since the French Revolution, just, you know, the 10 years prior, the people have been less enthusiastic about the papacy, and it's been less supported than previously. And it has less temporal authority. That's his point. It has religious authority, but it has less temporal authority. And so that's why he's highlighting that, I think. Okay, so we'll come back to this next week, and we'll look at it a little bit, and then we'll read a little bit more here, and then we'll go to look at the verses, get back into the scriptures.